Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. Thank you guys so much for listening. You guys mean the world to me, so just thank you. Okay, now let's jump right in. And I'll also be joined again by Greg Hunter because I've been talking about this case nonstop. Even my neighbors are blown away by details they didn't know in this case. So Greg wanted to be kind of surprised, though I did let the cat out of the bag a few times this week. But he wanted to be genuinely surprised by the event. So he's going to be doing off-the-cuff commentary, and we hope you guys enjoy. So welcome, Mr. Greg Hunter.
So it's like a blind taste test of hip-hop tales.
Yes, you did also do a rap before we started, which...
You didn't have to tell people about that.
Well, you did.
I was thinking about exclusively only quoting rap songs, like, subtly, like that Weatherman does.
Okay.
If you've seen it.
No, probably
it's
not.
Viral.
I don't get on the social media.
Your listeners have, but
I do, but not that often.
I'm not going to try to weave that in.
I mean, you can. You're a musician. You make all the music for this podcast. Rapper? Well, you're a good poet, though. So, yeah, you are good at rhyming.
It's the subject matter thing.
But can you speak as fast as I can?
Oh, I could be an auctioneer.
That's true. That's true. You could.
It's not the lack of speed that stunted my rap career. Hmm. It was this white skin.
Okay. Well, it still worked for Eminem, so I don't know what to tell you.
Also, it was growing up by the most hardworking blue-collar dad in the suburbs of Indianapolis that just didn't give me that rap edge.
Yeah, didn't give you that hard edge. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I know my way around a synthesizer. Yes, that's true.
I've been hitting the Bone Thugs really hard.
That's not a new thing.
Just to get in the mode of this two-part series, I've been hitting Crossroads the first of the month. I'm like, do you know what Reefer Hydro is, Greg? Do you know when they say pop, pop, that means guns? Hey.
She's a nuisance. Don't let her around your radio. Bone Thugs will come on.
I love it. If you ever, they're talented and you should check them out.
And then
they're gonna
give you
be stars.
A performance that reminds me of the white guy in Office Space listening to, like, was it Gangster's Paradise? In Office Space?
I know every lyric to that song.
I know you do too, but the scene where he pulls up and he turns his radio down at the intersection.
Whatever.
That's you.
Okay, stop bothering me. Anyways, we hope you guys enjoy. Sorry for our little riffraff at the beginning, but. This is just such a historical case.
And actually a rapper, by the way, Riff Raff.
Okay.
White rapper.
Okay,
let's go.
This is just such a historical case, perhaps one of the most famous in hip-hop history. I feel like it rivals like Lynyrd Skynyrd's plane going down, or what the song Don McLean's The Day the Music Dies was written about, which was another plane crash that had the famous musicians Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, and the Big Bopper on the flight. But the reason why this is almost way bigger in music history to me is because this was all no accident. The reason this story takes place is because it was marked with gang violence, the very public rivalry between two huge hip-hop stars, people rolling around with diamond-encrusted Rolexes and fancy cars, but also running with Southside gangs and the likes of Suge Knight, who he himself is in prison on an unrelated charge of voluntary manslaughter. And I was at first going to apologize for calling his case murder. I think I did that last week. And after I read it was voluntary manslaughter, I looked into it a little bit more and I watched the footage and it scared me. Apparently he claims to have acted in self-defense, but it does seem very voluntary. It's graphic.
It's intentional. I just can't believe his lawyer was able to win the argument that it was self-defense, so the charge became voluntary manslaughter because he was getting away from a potential shooting, but he was driving into a parking lot.
Like he backs up. He had the opportunity to leave, in my opinion, in the CCTV footage, and you guys can go look it up. It's very graphic. It's not that hard to find, but it is really graphic and shocking. But he backs up. He could have sped away, but he backs up and then just speeds right back into the Burger Stand parking lot, and it's really sad.
It's nuts. Can't believe it all developed on the set of Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, so basically, so he was sentenced to 28 years behind bars with the death of Terry Carter. So in 2015, Suge Knight struck and killed Carter with his truck during the production of the NWA biopic Straight Outta Compton, like Greg said. Following an argument with Cleobone Sloan, Knight's legal team attempted to argue that their client was acting in self-defense. Whatever. It was also a third strike, too, because he had several other charges for, you know, like violating his probation. There was a robbery with, you know, assault charges. I mean, he had a laundry
deadly
list.
Weapons.
Yeah.
Lots of uses of violence.
Yeah. I'd literally written in something before I saw the footage where I was just like, "All right, Suge, I didn't know that it was involved. I'm sorry, I called it murder, but then I watched the footage."
I was having a little snack before we did this podcast, and Rachel's like, "Yeah, I got to correct myself. Apparently, Suge Knight, he's Suge Nice."
Yeah.
Yeah. It's voluntary manslaughter. So he volunteered to kill these guys, but you know, I just want to correct it. But let's just dial up the footage and take a peek to see what happened.
And then I was like, "Nope, okay."
And then I saw Rachel almost fall out of her chair.
Yeah, he is trying to fight his he wants to change his plea. And I think he claims that his lawyers, this is all allegedly, because I just skimmed over it right before, claims that his lawyers
allegedly.
Didn't, yeah, everything that is said in this podcast is alleged.
Big alleged allegations.
I literally had written this. I'm going to read it still, but I don't know that I stand by it anymore. I said, "And Suge, I apologize for calling you scary as well. Maybe you're just reactionary. Who knows? But please, I meant no harm. You're just intimidating. However, in other interviews, you also seem kind and gentle and sweet, so you're just complicated."
Wow, Rachel.
But that video, if you guys can handle it, go look it up. But it is really sad and really graphic, and I feel very much for Terry Carter's family. Like it's heartbreaking. So, anyways, apologies rescinded. But let's have Suge introduce himself here. Via a speech he gave at the Source Awards, dripping in threats and innuendo.
First of all, I'd like to thank God. Second of all, I'd like to thank my whole entire Defo family on both sides, you know what I'm saying? I'd like to tell Tupac to keep his guards up. We ride with him. And one other thing I'd like to say. Any artist out there want to be an artist and want to stay a star and don't want to have to worry about the executive producer trying to be all in the videos, all on the record, dancing. Come to Death Row.
So if you watch that clip, and we'll probably post a video on our Instagram, Seven Deadly Sinners Podcast Instagram, but what's crazy is we know that allegedly Suge was associated with a fringe group of the Bloods, the Mob Pyrus. And he's also referring to Sean Combs there, essentially making fun of him for kind of like lip syncing and showing up in all of his artist videos. And Tupac was already in prison at the time for his sexual assault case. And Suge was about to be at his doorstep, or prison cell, better said. But let's recap for a second. Ayanna Jackson claims, and I believe her, to have been set up for a gang rape, essentially one in which Tupac was involved in. But he also claimed to his dying day to have not been involved in. And there are so many conflicting accounts of this, but we just have to believe her. Tupac at least brought her to the place in which she was attacked. And Haitian Jack, the man everyone told Tupac not to fraternize with, was also there. Again, this is also alleged. But Haitian Jack allegedly was involved in the rape of Ayanna as well. But Haitian Jack would receive no time for it. Tupac would be the only one to go to prison for it. At a party held by Sean Diddy Combs, Tupac ignored Haitian Jack, which was a huge slight to Haitian Jack. And this is also before Tupac was sent to prison for the sexual assault of Ayana. Haitian Jack didn't like this, and allegedly the next events transpired. While Tupac was in the fight for his defense against a sexual assault case, he needed money, and he needed money fast. So he agreed to do a track with Little Sean in exchange for $7,000. So he was at Quad Studios in Manhattan, the same place that Biggie and his crew were there with Sean Combs to record a track. Biggie was with Bad Boy Records, headed by Sean Combs. And the person Suge was talking about in that acceptance speech, who appears in his client's videos, was Sean Combs. So Sean started Bad Boy Records. And next week, when I interview Nick Bryant, who wrote the Franklin scandal, we are going to go into Sean's current allegations, as Nick has become a bit of an expert at that as well. But at the time Sean Combs had signed Biggie, he too was becoming one of the biggest rap stars, just like his buddy Tupac. But remember, there was a time when Tupac and Biggie were friends. Tupac had encouraged Biggie to stay with Sean Combs because Sean could make him a star. Sean had even been fired or left his previous record label for repping Biggie so hard. So what happens next is all the more hurtful to the former friends Tupac and Biggie, and it's something Tupac could never get over. Tupac, while at Quad Studios, was attacked, shot, pistol whipped, and humiliated. And who does he see when he goes up the elevator after the attack? None other than his now former friend Biggie and Sean Diddy Combs. Tupac immediately believes this was a setup, a hit on him, ordered by Sean Combs and Biggie. Coupled with the fact that he believes that the fact that he was the one charged with Ayana's rape and Haitian Jack avoided charges more than just parole, Tupac had also then ignored Haitian Jack at Diddy's party. And Tupac was also beat up and robbed during said attack. And the only thing not stolen from him was a Rolex, which was a gift from Haitian Jack, seeming to send some sort of sign. Tupac firmly and obsessively believed Biggie and Sean Combs and Haitian Jack were all involved. He also claims the look on their faces when the door of the elevator opened was of shock and guilt.
Guilt. Well,
I read another article too, though, where he, when he walked into Quad Studios, he heard the sound of like a familiar voice, and he was going to go greet that person. And that's when, you know, three armed men essentially jumped him. Yeah.
I mean, do you think there's an option where it was Haitian Jack, but P. Diddy and Biggie weren't involved with Haitian Jack? What's their connection?
I think we're going to find out it was more of, it's an association, and you'll hear about it. It's an association with kind of all of them. I kind of don't think that Biggie was involved. Biggie also literally never publicly spoke about this when like Tupac went into the media and was like claimed that Biggie was involved. Never publicly spoke about it. He did write a song that said that he, was the one that killed, like, he doesn't say Tupac's name, but like he alludes to, you know, there's some lyrics and something, but I don't know. I think they were all just trying to kind of threaten each other. I believe.
And why was Tupac was going to that studio?
So he needed to be in New York for his trial, and he also needed money for his defense attorney for the sexual assault case. And this literally happened one day. Like, he has to go to the hospital. He gets released. He's literally in a wheelchair, like leaving the hospital. There's footage of it. Goes to court and then is sentenced to prison for the sexual assault case. So he had to be in New York. A, he needed money. He was on a Little Sean track. That's, you know, that's why he you know, took the money. This is all, there's so much speculation and conspiracy theories and stuff. It's really hard to know.
He was going
to
be on a Little Sean track.
Yeah, so that's why he was there.
Going to the studio.
Yes. And then...
was Little Sean on Death Row or Bad Boy?
I don't know that.
Huh.
Yeah. Yeah, he gets jumped and then... we'll go into it. But maybe we should go into who the other player is, Biggie Smalls. His backstory. So, Biggie Smalls is an interesting character. I think he's also very complicated like Tupac. Biggie actually went to private school.
Private school? That doesn't really fit his gangster MO.
Yeah, it's a little confusing. Although he did... So, we'll get to it. His mom tried to help him as best she could. Like, he had a very comfortable life comparatively to Tupac. Because if we'll remember from last week... Tupac had parental figures in and out of prison, a mom who became addicted to crack cocaine, former father-type figures who were also addicted, and many people in his life went to prison. And he was actually quoted as saying this in an interview. He said, quote, "In my family, every black male with the last name Shakur that ever passed the age of 15 has either been killed or put in jail." And this is what he said in his deposition. "There are no Shakurs, black male Shakurs, out right now, free, breathing, without bullet holes in them or cuffs on his hands. None."
It is wild. It's wild because, like, not knowing much about their backstories beyond their hip-hop careers, like, judging the books by their covers, which is, this is why you shouldn't do that, I would have thought that Biggie had the real, true gangster hood, you know, poverty-stricken upbringing.
Because he is kind of like a not a menacing figure.
Yeah, he looks rough around the edges. He looks like a drug dealer. He looks like he's been through it. I know, but he looked more like he'd been through it, where Tupac just kind of had more of an angelic, handsome, artistic way about him that seemed that could only be blessed by the upbringing of a more articulate, aristocratic upbringing. But it wasn't the case.
Well, but I do think his mom was extremely intelligent. And, you know, succumbing to addiction doesn't make someone, you know, not smart, for example. Like, she actually represented herself in court, like we talked about, and she was, you know, a vigilante. I think he was raised in a kind of like a very poetic sort of, like,
yeah.
And she also sent him to, like, he studied ballet and you know, I think, and I'll go into it, I think Biggie chose a thug life. I think Tupac was born into very hard circumstances. I think Biggie chose to be.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? So, within just 24 hours of his attack at Quad Studios, like I said, he was wheeled out of the hospital in a wheelchair. And then he was sentenced to years in prison for the sexual assault of Ayana. And like I said, the interesting thing about Biggie, though, is he actually had a pretty good start in life until he made the decision to go the other way. Biggie was born on May 21st, 1972, in Brooklyn, New York. His parents were from Jamaica. His mom taught preschool, and his dad was a welder and a local politician for some time. His dad did leave the family when Biggie was 2, but that didn't stop his mom from working her darndest to provide for her boy. She actually worked 2 jobs in order to, and this fact's going to blow your mind. She actually worked 2 jobs in order to send her son to private school, the Roman Catholic Bishop Laughlin Memorial High School. And guess who's the alumni there? Rudy Giuliani. He's just one, like, this is a fancy, this is a fancy ass school.
Sounds pretty fancy.
Yeah. But,
you know, those Catholic churches, they take all your money they can.
Oh, absolutely. I know my niece and nephew went to one or whatever, and I know it was like, yeah.
It was always the Catholic school kids who were the worst.
My niece and nephew are not.
Oh, I didn't mean that. Like,
I was like, they're actually angelic.
When I grew up.
Yeah. Yeah, you and I just went out to straight up public school, and you went to a pretty rough public school.
I did.
Yeah.
There were gangs in my school, but my school was the...
Did you have metal detectors going?
Privileged few that we decided to bus all of the kids from the inner city in, so they would have a better opportunity to education, I guess. But They didn't come there for education. Our basketball team was better, though.
Well, Indiana is the best at basketball.
When Conference Indiana produces more NBA prospects than any other, like, regular
5A high school. I'm certain we've talked about this.
Yeah. Go Indiana.
Yeah. Well,
14 of the largest 15 gymnasiums in the world.
Oh, my God.
In Indiana. High school gymnasiums. We love basketball. Go cool. Pacers.
Cool. I had 52 people in my graduating class, and we all wore camo, and, you know, I'm sure half the people are on meth now. Anywho's will be. but Biggie at this time apparently convinced his mom to let him go to public school, and he subsequently transferred to the George Westinghouse Career and Technical High School, which is where he met friends that he would run the streets with. And Biggie did actually, and I'm going to use a term here, sling crack cocaine for some time. And he ended up doing 9 months in prison. And he would put the crack in his socks and sell it on the street. You know, thug life. But he did drop out of high school at 17 after getting his girlfriend pregnant. Now, this is not Faith Evans. This was a former girlfriend who kind of stayed in his life, you know, in and out throughout the rest of his very short-lived life. But Biggie had actually been really good at English, but he felt he needed to provide for his new baby that was on the way. So yeah, he dropped out at 17. And he also started his rap career and was signed by none other than Sean Combs. So Biggie is on the rise, and Tupac is having a hellish time in prison and is being told by other inmates that Biggie had a hand in Tupac's attack at Quad Studios, and Tupac is fuming. And this is where the hip-hop East Coast-West Coast feud was ignited.
So it was Tupac getting jumped at Quad Studios in New York that really started the East versus West rap war.
Yeah, he felt completely convicted that Biggie and Sean Combs were involved in him getting jumped.
And that was reinforced by prisoners. Could have been hearsay.
Totally. But it also was reinforced by the fact that Haitian Jack didn't go to prison for the sexual assault of Ayana.
But wouldn't that also mean that the court system was in on it somehow? Or was it that everyone testified against Tupac and Haitian Jack's crew?
I feel it's very possible because Tupac was so outwardly spoken against the police. Like he had gotten into a phase, and even more so when he got out of prison, where he was like, you know, he also accidentally, you know, like shot a cop in the butt, and he was, you know, acting out, like spitting. He was kind of getting into his gangster era. I think he wasn't well liked at that point. He was by like the public and women and, you know, and
but
other
the state.
Yeah, I
the
think
court
that,
systems.
I think they were happy to put him.
Yeah.
Put him away.
Okay.
So meanwhile, when Tupac goes to prison, right after being jumped, meanwhile, while Tupac is in prison, back on the West Coast, Biggie is accepting award after award at the Source Awards. Suge is giving his inciting incident type speech, and the Southside Crips, many believe, are allegedly acting as Sean Combs' security detail at various events. Suge Knight was also ramping up his operation. Funded by drug money from his buddy who was in prison, who couldn't access his drug money, Suge was given a loan and then started Death Row Records. And at that time, Dr. Dre also wanted out of his contract with Eazy-E, who also funded the NWA label with some drug money. But Suge, when he came into the picture, and Dre being upset with his measly cut of money, because Eazy was taking, because he'd funded you know, most of the NWA production, but once they started making money, Dre was like, yeah, no, you can't get the large cut, like, I want out. So Suge then sent, with other cronies of his, to threaten Eazy-E. And when they showed up with lead pipes and a photo of Eazy's mom's house, Eazy gave up and let Dre and others from the label free of their contracts on the spot. I mean, Suge is his size, his penchant for intimidation, ruthless qualities, and thirst for blood and money made him extremely scary. And I can see how Easy was just like, all right.
Hey, I mean, it adds to the tale. That's how business was handled in the hip-hop world back in that day, not in boardrooms.
Yeah, it truly is crazy. It was like the hip-hop Wild West. Like, it was just, you know.
Now, the question that still lingers to me is, did Sean P. Diddy Combs fund his label with drug money?
I feel like he's too much of a pussy. I mean, it's possible.
That's what I was thinking. I thought it was fashion show deals. But I guess Nick will tell us.
Yeah, I'm going to wait
on
till
the next episode.
Yeah, I'm going to wait till Nick says it because I was about ready to say something that I would maybe regret. So, you know what? We'll let Nick explain because Nick's a bit of an expert on this type of thing.
Perfect.
But I think you can sort of surmise what I'm alluding to. And apparently Tupac's association with Suge wasn't a healthy one for him. And shortly after Tupac's death, which we will go into, there was an article written and a quote from Tupac's friend that isn't overly biased, actually, because, like we've learned, Tupac was a complicated man who had good and bad sides. He did some terrible things. He suffered some terrible things. I'm giving no excuse for him, and I feel for that poor girl if he set her up to get harmed, and may have physically harmed her himself, though he denies most of it. But here's the quote that I feel sums up what I've been researching. I believe Tupac's life changed after prison, where he was also allegedly raped. And his life also changed after now being essentially owned by Suge Knight. So regardless, his friends stated in the New Yorker article, quote, I think Tupac, you brought down one of the most evil empires of my time. One of his friends who he grew up in the music business says, he did not intend to romanticize Tupac, this friend. Like many others, they acknowledged that Tupac was famously split between what he himself referred to as his good and his evil sides, and that it was his darker side that seemed to have gained dominion during much of his tenure at death row. Nonetheless, these friends insist that that was not the real Tupac. The real Tupac was gifted, sympathetic, intent on articulating the pain of young blacks in the inner cities, and the real Tupac was trying to leave death row when he was killed.
It's a bit of a bombshell. Didn't know he was trying to leave.
Yeah.
Thought he was trying to represent.
Well, the thing is that Suge owned him. So the way...
Yeah, I never knew about that. I never knew Suge, that's how he got him to sign, you know, to death row, was that he made him a deal while he was in prison.
Yeah. So Suge goes to New York and gets Tupac out of prison, out of a hellish situation. But essentially, Tupac entered into a hellish situation with Suge because it wasn't necessarily just a bailout. It was a loan. And Tupac would have to work his ass off in order to pay back that loan to Suge. So now let's cut to the night that Tupac died. And I'll introduce more characters to you. So like I said, yeah, all the deal actually meant was that Suge owned him. And Suge would be with Tupac the night he was shot and fatally died a week later. So here's the latest on events that occurred the night Tupac was shot in Las Vegas after attending a Mike Tyson fight. And I say the latest because just about 7 months ago, the last remaining person who could have been involved, and by last remaining, I mean the last one still alive, was just arrested for his own involvement in Tupac's murder. I would say, I don't believe, and I would like to hear your opinion on this, that Suge Knight likely was not involved. I highly doubt he would have got himself shot in the head in a setup, so I'm just going to knock that conspiracy theory out because, as we know from Tupac and others, many of these guys are not great with guns, and I don't think that Suge would have trusted the man who killed Tupac to just casually shoot him and kind of graze his skull if that was part of the plan. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that Suge was involved in the setup to kill? Because there's a lot of conspiracy theories that say that Suge set up both of the murders. Suge got shot.
Yeah, I feel like Tupac was on Suge's team, so it doesn't seem to benefit him. You know, he just paid all this money to the government that he's not going to get back, you know, for Tupac to get released from prison, and in turn, he's got to make a number of albums for Death Row and Suge, so, like, having him killed wouldn't help Suge in any way that I could see advantageous. Now, that being said, with his reputation and his history, I think that certainly Suge probably poked the wrong bear, incited violence on the other side to a level that could have put Tupac in more of harm's way than he even realized was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that it was Suge's call.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I will say that this is like one of the times, and he could just be manipulative, but I did kind of find Suge sympathetic, and we're going to call to this clip that he does an interview shortly after Tupac's death, and he kind of explains, you know, what went down. And just based on his demeanor, I'm not seeing it. So let's listen to this clip.
Okay.
Suspects or motive in the murder of rapper and actor Tupac Shakur, who died last Friday the 13th after being gunned down in a drive-by following the Mike Tyson-Bruce Seldon boxing match September 7th. Meanwhile, on Thursday night in Los Angeles, we spoke with Marion Suge Knight, head of Tupac's label Death Row Records, and the man who was driving the car sitting right next to Tupac when he was shot. Knight, who himself was grazed in the head by a bullet, was prevented by his lawyers from addressing the shooting itself. But here, for the first time on television, he speaks publicly about its aftermath.
How are you feeling, and how are you doing physically?
I feel like this. I feel that the last word is always God. But Pac saved my life. The reason why I say Pac saved my life, I got shot in the head, got grazed some other places, but I still got the bullet in my head. It's still there. But as far as trying to get him to the hospital, didn't make me realize that I was shot. Because usually when you get shot in the head, the first thing the person do is panic. You know, bam, I'm shot in the head, I'm about to die. You know. And once you do that, you can't drive nowhere. My whole thing was, Pac, he was shot. I'm like, you shot? I'm going to get you to the hospital. I'm driving, telling him I'm going to get you to the hospital, kick back. Pac looked at me and said, you know what? You need the doctor more than me. You're the one shot in your head. And we laughed the whole time going to find out went to the hospital. That's the conversation we had. It wasn't, Pac was a man the whole time. It wasn't that he was like, oh, I'm shot. He cracking jokes. They're like, yeah, they shot me. He said, but you shot in your head. Look at your head. Your head bleed. Look how much it's bleed. That was Pac. And I'm like, man, shut up. I'm going to get you to the doctor.
So he was conscious on the way to the hospital.
He was conscious on the way to the hospital. He was conscious in the ambulance. He was conscious after they did the surgery.
What was the last thing that he said to you?
They love me. We was on the thing. It was getting there. I'm like, Pac, we the last one left. When we talking, this is how we talking. He said, homie, I'm straight. I love you, homie. I'm going to be straight. I love you, too. That's what it was.
There was a report earlier this week in the New York Post that Tupac was looking to leave Death Row Records. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
You should answer that. You don't take a person like Tupac who, if you listen to every song on All Eyes on Me, every song on Machiavelli, every time he do an interview, what's the first thing he say? Death Row. Tupac loved Death Row. Tupac loved me. I loved him. I mean, Tupac took Death Row to the next level. I mean, we worked hard, and we laid the foundation down, and Snoop took the baton, and he ran with it, and he did a great job with it. When Tupac got the baton, not only did he win the race, he finished so fast that he was able to sit back and drink some Thug Passion and come up with another plan. I mean, if you'd ask Tupac that question, then was he planning on leaving Death Row, he definitely would have cussed you out.
And now we're going to go through the players that could have been involved and the new developments that I mentioned that just happened like 7 months ago. So On the night of September 7th, 1996, Shakur was in the back seat of a black BMW that Knight was driving when a white Cadillac pulled up on the right side and shot at both Tupac and Suge Knight. Knight was wounded but survived. And like we just listened to in that interview, Tupac, I don't think anyone thought that Tupac was going to die. He'd been shot before, you know, he'd shot other people by dropping guns and Tupac was genuinely more worried about Suge Knight than he was himself, because Suge was shot in the head. And they, now that new information has come out, police and prosecutors say the shooting stemmed from a fierce competition for dominance in the musical genre that was pitted against the East Coast members of the Bloods gang sect against the West Coast members of the Crips sect that Davis has said he led in Compton, California. So Keefe Davis is the guy that was recently arrested, the only one that is still alive who was in the car when the shooting happened and apparently procured the gun.
He was in the white Cadillac?
Yes.
Okay.
So in the white Cadillac, all right, there is Orlando Baby Lane Anderson. And law enforcement authorities long suspected that Anderson was the gunman. He was 22 at the time. Davis was his uncle. So Keefe Davis was Orlando Baby Anderson's uncle. But they were like, they were so close, they were more like brothers, all right?
Yeah.
And Orlando had been attacked by Tupac and Suge and probably other crew members at the Mike Tyson fight right before.
Okay, so Orlando's already primed and ready to be pissed off and
absolutely
fight back.
And Davis essentially kind of like ordered it, and that's what he has basically been charged with, ordered it in providing the gun. He said, "Them jumping my nephew gave us the ultimate green light to do something." And he actually wrote this in a book, which is insane.
Wow.
Davis said he then obtained a handgun from an associate and tossed it in the backseat of a Cadillac, but did not say who fired the fatal shots. Anderson was sitting in the backseat of the car behind his uncle. So it does kind of seem like they didn't have a plan on who was going to shoot Tupac.
Well, I mean, the whole thing doesn't really seem premeditated beyond like, you know, an hour's time, like after the fight.
Yeah, exactly. And so they were basically just like going around Las Vegas, like looking for like Tupac and Suge. And I think Orlando was pissed off and embarrassed. And again, they're all so reactionary and angry. And at certain points, I don't blame them. Like, the black community had been treated like shit. But, you know, they didn't need to treat each other like shit, you know. And Tupac and Suge did attack him. And so I think he was just sort of like, all right.
I think it's also a deeper code of honor. But, you know, in this thug life community, you know, to not let yourself get treated like that.
Yeah, exactly. I completely agree. So then there was this guy named Freaky Smith that was in the back seat as well.
These names.
Well, they all have ridiculous names.
Haitian Jack, Freaky Smith.
Yeah.
And these guys aren't even rappers. They're just like
well, they're
part of the gang.
They're pretty much gang members. So to reiterate, Davis said he obtained a handgun from an associate and tossed it in the back seat of the Cadillac, but did not say who fired the fatal shots. Anderson was sitting in the back seat of the car behind his uncle. Neither the Cadillac nor the gun used in the shooting were ever recovered, according to retired Las Vegas police detective Clifford Mogg, who was assigned to the investigation in 2018. He said, quote, "We were never able to identify the person who rented the car, where it was rented from, and then when it comes to the gun, we have never recovered as of this date the weapon that was used in the murder." Anderson, who denied involvement in Shakur's killing, died 2 years later in what police said was an unrelated shooting at a Compton car wash. And all of the people that were witnesses, were there, they've all died besides Keefe Davis. So then there was DeAndre Frankie Smith, also known as Big Dre. Smith was in the back seat of the car that night, sitting next to Anderson. Although authorities have said they believe Anderson pulled the trigger, the grand jury testimony challenged that theory. Devontae Lee, a former associate of Davis, told the grand jury that it was Smith who shot Shakur and Knight. He said Anderson tried reaching over Smith, but didn't have a clear shot out of the left rear passenger window. A former associate, who wasn't in the car but recounted a conversation he had with Smith days after the shooting, said that Smith took the gun from Anderson, opened fire, and let Anderson take credit for Shakur's death. Smith himself was only 30 when he died in 2004 of natural causes. Then there's Terry Bubble Up Brown. Brown was driving the Cadillac from which the shots were fired. Davis said in his memoir that they were driving towards Las Vegas Boulevard that night and spotted Shakur hanging out the window of the BMW waving to fans. Davis told Brown to make a U-turn, and they drove slowly past the rapper's convoy until Davis said they found who we were seeking. That's a quote. Brown died in 2015 and a shooting at a medical marijuana dispensary in Compton. So there's a lot going on here. The only one that's still alive is Keefe Davis. And when they arrested him in Las Vegas, they had searched his house months prior. And this is, again, like only like 7 months ago. And he had evidence that would link him to Tupac's shooting in his home.
Really?
Yeah. So for whatever reason, they've gone back and tried to reinvestigate this when they were completely ignoring it from the beginning.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Kevin McMahill. I'm the sheriff of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. 27 years. For 27 years, the family of Tupac Shakur has been waiting for justice. We are here today to announce the arrest of 60-year-old Dwayne Keith Davis, a.k.a. Keefe D, for the murder of Tupac Shakur.
Yeah, he's been apprehended, and I mean, he admitted it in a book that he wrote.
Yeah, it doesn't look like they were trying that hard. Yeah, it sounds like there's almost a sense of pride for this man about that killing.
Yeah, I think so. So, do you want to cut to Biggie?
Cut to.
Okay. So now let's cut to 6 months later. Biggie.
Wow. It was only 6 months later.
Mm-hmm. And Tupac was only 25. I think Biggie was 24 when he was killed. They were fucking kids. Kids.
Yeah.
I mean, it's heartbreaking. But so now 6 months later, Biggie is attending the Soul Train Awards, okay? And it's important to mention that Biggie actually never responded to Tupac's repeated claims in the media that Biggie had set him up for the attack at the studio. And Tupac, for his own right, also in an act of revenge, also went after Faith Evans, Biggie's estranged wife, later. They even, like, walked the red carpet together. Who knows if they slept together. But, like, the rivalry was so big and so... It just got so gross at a certain point.
Yeah.
That there's no way someone wasn't dying, and they were also all packing guns, and you know, the
and kind of makes me a little worried about this Kendrick and Drake beef going on right now.
Okay,
I know you're probably not even aware.
I have no idea what it's about.
But you time these episodes well to be in correlation with like the hottest beef and rap since this.
Oh, shit.
Just about.
I mean, people do crazy shit. I mean, I was even, like, reading, like, Suge's rap sheet and stuff. And, like, he was at a Chris Brown event when, like, at One Oak, which I've been to, I had been to several times living in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
And was, you've been there, I'm sure.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Like, I didn't even know that Suge Knight was shot there a bunch of times. Like, it's...
He was shot there like a bunch of different times? No.
He was shot a few times.
A few bullets in the same night. Yeah. Okay.
But it's just like,
See, I'd stop going if I got shot.
Yeah. Like, if it was more than one incident, it's probably time.
You don't even have to shoot me to get me to not go to One Oak anymore.
Yeah. We don't have a club within, I would say, 200 miles of us right now.
Oh, easy. Easy. Yeah.
So anyways, yeah, like Biggie never responds to, although he did release, yeah, like I said, some lyrics in the album that were questionable.
A diss track.
Yeah, it was, okay.
That's the term.
Yeah, okay. But, so after the Soul Train Awards, Biggie attends the after party to the Stars, and, like, everyone's there. It's at the Peterson Museum right off of Wilshire.
The Peterson!
No, it's actually very cool. It's an automotive museum, and I actually was a member there at a certain point.
I've been to the Peterson 100 times.
Yeah, no, that place is.
They got the
so
Batmobile.
Cool.
They got a hydrogen car. They got all kinds of
stuff. That place is so cool. And I actually
just
think
used to live right there too, like right at that intersection.
Oh yeah, you did live. Yeah, yeah.
Man,
that was before we dated.
I was living
but
in hip hop.
And history. Okay, so I didn't even know that that's where it actually happened until I believe I was visiting the Peterson Museum and like someone told me or something, and I was like, it was like right here. So
wow.
So the after party is at the Peterson Museum, and the party's hopping and it's getting overcrowded. Biggie has his own security detail. He told his mom not to worry about him. He spoke to her right before he went there because she was very just worried because, you know, Tupac had already been killed, but he was like, Tupac's dead. You know, like Suge couldn't retaliate because he was in prison himself at that point for whatever Suge did at the time. And Biggie had told his mom that the LAPD was protecting him that night. So on March 7th, Biggie, so let's go back to the awards. He had presented an award to Tony Braxton at the 1997 Soul Train Music Awards. And again, this is like 6 months after Tupac's killed, okay? He was booed by some audience members. But the next morning, he was scheduled to travel to London. But instead, on the evening of March 8th, he and the Bad Boy Records entourage decided to attend the party, hosted by Vibe Magazine. And everyone was there. So it's this place off Wilshire Boulevard. What would you say? It's Wilshire and Fairfax?
Yeah, it's Wilshire and Fairfax.
Yeah, Wilshire and Fairfax, yeah. And everyone was there. Faith Evans, Queen Latifah, Aaliyah, Chris Tucker, The Wayans Brothers, Genuine, Irv Gotti, Jewel, Jermaine Dupri, The Lox, DeBrat, Escape, Missy Elliott, Timberland, Goody Mob, Martin Lawrence, Kenny Burns. I mean, the list goes on. And the party got huge to the point where the fire department was called because it got way too big, way too loud, way too smoke filled. Just
sounds huge. Like my parties in LA.
Yeah, sure.
Rich Wheeler 25, anybody?
So it got so big that it had to be shut down. There was also a guy there. Or nearby, who, and again, no one is good with guns in this scenario, who dropped his gun, then fired it to make sure that it still worked, which some people speculate that like that set off like alarm bells, but like I think he was just not that smart. So many guns that so many people don't know how to use. And I myself have a Yosemite Sam experience that I'm not proud of. Granted, a gun didn't go off, but I thought I was going to protect the family on the ranch when people showed up here at 3 a.m. And I packed a revolver into Greg's large jacket that I was wearing where the pocket was too big.
She tried to pack like a 10-inch pistol in a 4-inch, you know, secret pocket inside a jacket,
yeah,
which
not
promptly fell out of the jacket as soon as she came outside, where
I'm
me and
the like
my
neighbor,
old bandmate who lived with me, were very well handling the people who had showed up on our property, who we were just at a bar with drinking and weren't aware that we invited them to come over in their Batmobile ATV.
Yeah, but I was like,
machine.
I gotta protect the family, I got this handled, you guys don't even know. So I walk up, gun drops from the jacket. No one says anything. And I literally just exit out of scene, quietly pick the gun off the
Homer Simpsons
ground
back into the bushes. And luckily,
No one says anything.
The people from the town we're in, you can drop a gun in the middle of a conversation circle and it won't faze them. Like, all of them are like, my gun's still on me and loaded, little lady. Like, better luck next time.
I was new here. I was too big for my britches.
I can't believe we're telling this story.
Yeah, whatever.
Maybe that means you have a rap career.
I think I could. I mean, it would be embarrassing, probably, but you never know.
I mean, when Bone Thugs comes on, when you go, bum, 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 bum,
and I know every fucking lyric of that. So Biggie and Sean Combs leave in separate SUVs, and their security is also in a separate SUV. So on March 9th, 1997, around 12:30 a.m., Biggie left with his entourage and two green Chevrolet GMC Suburbans to attend an after party in the Hollywood Hills. So prior to leaving, the fire department had shut down the party. And I think that like Biggie and Sean Combs and everyone were like happy to leave at this point. And Biggie traveled in the front passenger seat alongside his associates, Damian D. Rock Butler, Junior Mafia member Little Cease, and driver Gregory G. Money Young. What is that? Were you there?
G. Money.
Shoot. Sean Combs traveled in the other vehicle with Eugene Gene Deal, Anthony Tone Jacobs, Stevie J, and driver Kenny Story. The two SUVs were trailed by a Chevy Blazer carrying Bad Boy Records director of security Paul Offord, and driven by an off-duty Inglewood police officer named Reggie Blaylock. By 12:45 a.m., the streets were crowded with people leaving the museum. Wallace's SUV, stopped at a red light at the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and South Fairfax Avenue. And 2 minutes later, a dark-colored 1994 to 1996 Chevy Impala drove to the side of Wallace's Suburban. So it basically also cut off in between, like, Biggie and Sean's SUVs, and then also the security. So, like, Biggie was essentially cornered. Okay.
Okay.
And the driver of the Impala, a black male, lowered his window, drew a 9mm blue steel pistol, and fired at the Suburban. Four bullets hit Biggie. Biggie's entourage rushed him to. So, Sean Combs actually then got, like, they were able to get over there because obviously the Impala sped off, and he opened the door. Saw his friend and client, you know, just in a bad way. They rushed him to Cedars, which is not super far from there.
No.
The doctors performed an emergency thoracotomy, and he was pronounced dead at 1:15 a.m. So he died within 30 minutes, basically, at the age of 24. So I think three of his wounds were not fatal, but the last one, the fourth bullet was fatal, entering through Biggie's right hip, striking several vital organs, including his colon, liver, heart, and upper lobe of his left lung, before stopping in his left shoulder area. And what's so sad is that his mom literally did not want him to go there that night. She's like, you're on the West Coast. They don't like you right now. And Biggie was like, hey, Tupac's dead. Suge's in prison. I will be fine. LAPD are protecting me. Apparently Sean Combs had the Crips protecting him. And yeah, it's really
Mama always knows best.
I know. It's
motherly instincts. Gotta trust him.
Yeah. It's truly sad how these people let themselves destroy each other and themselves. Like, it really makes me very sad.
But I mean, in both cases, you know, I really thought there was more like ordering from Suge Knight or ordering from Sean P. Diddy Combs, but it seems like it's more like fringe gang members who wanted to get involved.
Yeah,
fans of each label being like, yo, I represent this. Fuck them at the highest level. Like,
I can see your point. At a certain point, though, they said that Sean Diddy had, like, ordered, like paid $1 million for the hit on both of them, but that wouldn't make sense because Biggie was his biggest money-making. It does seem more fringe. Like, they were all so involved, like, with the Southside Crips and the Bloods, and then just...
Well, that's also what really did it. Like, you know, Suge having Blood gang members be his security, and...
Diddy having Crips.
Diddy having Crips. Like, well, like, okay, now you're just, you know, stirring the pot with more bad blood.
Yeah. But what's weird, too, though, is like we talked about last episode, that at Death Row Records, both the Crips and the Bloods would come hang out there. So... I don't quite understand, but it does seem...
Well, that doesn't make sense. Yeah, I don't know. I mean...
Yeah, it just does seem like a...
Maybe it was
almost
a neutral...
Almost like a big accident? Not accident, but... Emotions got too high, and I think that every person's brain changed from being in prison. I think that it was also... You know, the violence of the time, the Rodney King, and then the LA riots had happened. There was, you know, so much going on. There was so much killing that they saw, and just...
I mean, all of that aside, yeah, I think the people who carried out the murders... Yeah, I mean, like, that is the world they grew up in. They did see people being killed... every other day. And that is the world Tupac came from. There's not a Shakur who's not, you know, either 6 feet under or behind bars.
It's so sad.
But it's like, it does seem that in both circumstances, the killers in each murder weren't musicians, rappers, or even affiliated with either label, really.
Mm-hmm.
But just fringe supporters of one side or the other.
There was even some LAPD cops or whatever that kind of tried to gain fame from this whole thing, but I think it boils down to, and it makes me very sad. Like, do you remember the girl with the yellow shoes? Remember when I interviewed her with Be Here for a While?
Yeah,
and just the experience of, I mean, her mom protected her, but at one point, if I'm remembering correctly, like, she had to literally, like, duck below because there was, like, in the Chicago neighborhood she lived in, like, bullet fire was coming through their house. Like, it makes me very sad that there are people that...
There are dangerous places to live in impoverished places in big cities, and it's, you know,
yeah, it's just, yeah, I think everything contributed to it, and I blame Ronald Reagan. War on drugs was not a good idea.
Okay, it's all Reagan's fault. All right,
I blame him. Don't treat people like shit.
No one saw coming. The rap war was caused by Ronald Reagan.
Don't treat people like shit. All right. Don't force them into gang violence because they have nothing. Don't treat them like shit. All right, Ronald? You weren't that great of a guy yourself. Okay, I said it. All right. Guys, let's end the podcast now before I get in trouble.
Yeah, before you start a North versus South gang war.
Listen, I'm on the side of Tupac, Biggie. I'm not on the side of Sean Diddy. Sorry, and we'll discuss that next week. But, like... I'm on the side of them. They were doing the best they fucking could.
You know, I think they were true artists. And when a true artist emerges, I think people find themselves idealizing them in ways that can, well, you know, and spark outrage and violence when their rival,
yeah,
you know, gets accused of things that maybe they actually weren't responsible for.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's part of the reality with the situation is that both the notorious B.I.G. and Tupac Shakur were larger than life, incredible artists, and really took a mirror to society in so many ways at that point in time. And a lot of, you know, troubled gang members in Compton saw themselves in each of those people, or vice versa. Gang member from the Bronx or Brooklyn or wherever in New York, you know, and took pride in the music that each artist is putting out to a level that they'd live and die for, and they proved it. And, you know, like, it's a testament of both of those men's power, good or bad, wrong or right. It was some serious artistic power there, and maybe the world couldn't handle them both.
Oh, that's a good line. All right, let's end on that. I love you very much. Did you just mic drop? No. Okay.
I did, but I dropped the mic. I can't pick it back up. I dropped.
All right. I love you very much. Thank you for doing this podcast. And thank you guys so much for listening. Yeah, this has been a fascinating case to dig into. And next week, we're going to like talk about Diddy, but also the Franklin scandal. I've become like best friends with Nick Bryant, the author of the Franklin scandal. So we're going to talk about Epstein, Diddy, Franklin scandal, how all of these rings sort of intersect. And he's sweet. He's a genius. And I'm really looking forward to you hearing from him. So thank you guys. I love you so much. Good night.